mainstream politicians have forgotten ordinary folks. An effort to pursue free trade and a lot of other things, the so-called neoliberal agenda, they've neglected the people who didn't get a college education, are struggling, they're not earning a living wage, they can never put aside enough money, they have no savings, and they're very worried. And then they see crime rising, and they talk about immigration coming in. They're really upset about it.
That was the voice of Ted Smith, former diplomat, C-suite executive, and one of the wisest heads on the intersection of Irish and American politics. I'm your host, Martin Nutty, and welcome to a check-in episode of Irish Stew. This is Ted's fourth appearance on the podcast in what has now become an annual discussion. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to host Ted, and if you're interested in matters political, I think you'll enjoy this episode. Welcome to a check-in episode with our guest, Ted Smith, who is now, on this episode, a four-time guest on the podcast. So welcome, Ted.
Thanks, Martin. Always a pleasure to be here.
So I'd like to have Ted coming on the podcast because I like to talk politics, as some people might know about me, and there's no better man positioned to talk about politics and the nexus of politics between the Irish worlds and the American worlds. And then we'll probably have a smattering of what's going on with Britain. But let's start here, Ted. We're recording this on November 29th. We'll be releasing it at the start of the new year. It's an interesting upcoming year in America. There'll be a presidential election. We just had a off-year election about 3 weeks ago in America. What did we learn, and is it relevant for the upcoming year?
Absolutely relevant, and it was very good news for Democrats. In fact, if you wanted that confirmed, you could look at the Wall Street Journal run an editorial, and that editorial is well to the right of center, close to Genghis Khan, and their headline was, "Are Republicans Tired of All the Losing?" They pointed out that Democrats handed Republicans another drubbing with their twin issue set of abortion rights and fear and loathing of the MAGA GOP Republicans. So they went on to say that in many battleground states, key states, Virginia, Ohio, and in Kentucky, pretty right-wing conservative states, Democrats won. And what people realized was that the Trump form of politics, while it may be gaining a few non-college educated working class people, that's more than offset by the flight of moderates and suburban women from the Republican Party. And the final kicker is Republicans lost or did worse than expected in 2018, 2020, and 2022, and again in 2023. And their journal's conclusion is that won't change until Republican voters finally get tired of all the losing. So you see a bit of that with the recent decision by the Koch brothers to support Nikki Haley in the election for nomination against Trump. Now, that's a bit of a long shot, you might say, but Ed Luce has come out in the Financial Times and said she's well worth considering, because if you look at the primary race next year, there's a slight chance that Trump could be beaten by Haley. Now, what do you think? I think it might be wishful thinking by some Republicans, but we could talk about that, Martin, if you like.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting talking point, and I think Nikki Haley is very far off from making a dent in what seems to be a unstoppable Trump train. But politics change quickly, and all of a sudden, if the other dwarves in the Republican nomination contest fall away and leave the field clear for a two-person race, she may get a second look. There is some weariness, certainly in the Republican Party, in terms of dealing with the whole MAGA thing. And then the wiser heads, I believe, may question the electability of Donald Trump. My view of the election is very simply this. It's an election of thirds. One-third will show up for Donald Trump. One-third will show up for Joe Biden. And then there's a third in the middle that are somewhat persuadable.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And unfortunately, it comes down to about 5 or 6 states out of 50. I mean, it's an absurd election in a way. And I pointed out in a review of a new book in the Irish Times recently by Frank Foer. It was about a great book about Biden, actually. It gives you a lot of confidence that Biden has both the will and the physical ability to run the country and to run it very successfully for a second term. All those people who worry about his age, we can talk about that separately if you like. But what that brings out is that the things he's doing to try and create jobs for working class Americans and to make life more affordable, those are beginning to come about now, but it takes time for that to manifest itself. He successfully defeated inflation, which was a really core issue. But the jobs for ordinary people are slowly coming on stream, and the wages that increase with that. And I think if you get into a second term, 24, 25, you'll see that coming about, and people will very well realize that Joe Biden is the best thing that America has for itself going forward. And you mentioned about the one-third middle, particularly women and suburbanites and young people. If they come out to vote, Biden wins. Now, he wins anyway in the popular vote, but he wins the Electoral College, which, as we all know, is not very democratic. But he has to win by close to the popular vote by close to 8 to 10 million voters, which, of course, is crazy by any other democratic standards that exist out there. So I'm very hopeful that most people will come out for Biden in the end. I agree with you, Trump is a likely nominee. The only way that Haley could possibly make it is she's focusing very much in New Hampshire in January. If she comes in second, then hopefully DeSantis and all the others fall away and put their support behind her. And the next big primary vote would be South Carolina, where she was governor. And that's in February. And if she comes in a strong second there, it would put her in a good position for Super Tuesday on March 5, when many states have their primary. So that's the only scenario by which she could win. And of course, at that time in March, various Trump trials are coming to court. So he'll be distracted by that. Maybe Americans will be too. Trials are everything from insurrection on January 6th, Capitol Hill, the payment of hush money to a porn star, to misuse of classified documents in Florida, not just misuse, but lying about having them. And then, of course, Trump's attempts to overthrow the state presidential result in Georgia. So a lot going on, maybe wishing and hoping still for those Republicans who would like a non-Trump approach. And maybe they're missing the point that the Republican Party has largely gone Trumpist. Nikki Haley is no moderate. Nor is DeSantis. So we shouldn't forget that. They're very much Trumpy type in their politics. And that leaves Joe Biden as the best hope to preserve the middle ground in America.
I want you to put your press hat on from back in your days in the Department of Foreign Affairs in Ireland. Because what's dominating the press in terms of presidential coverage in the United States is Biden's age. We're not talking about the reduction of inflation. We're not talking about the improvement of the economy. What's your sense? And I have a sense that, let's say, the media generally has an interest in a close race, in a horse race, in an inexpensive to cover race, and they're really missing the boat on what's really at stake here.
Well, that's always a danger. It's easier to write about a horse race than it is about policy. And Trump realized that running against Hillary in 2016, they all wanted more Trump and less policy. And he's a personality, he's a celebrity, he makes news, he's like catnip. And if it bleeds, it leads. Usual issues for media, trying to get people to click on their articles. And I have a few journalist friends that tell me that their editors say, write more about Trump, because they get clickbait. And whereas if you write about inflation coming down, so inflation's coming down. That's not as interesting as Trump talking about some border issue or being outrageous about vermin and his opposition calling them vermin and so forth. So there seems to be nothing extreme that Trump does that A, doesn't get publicity, and B, gets people excited and interested. And then people go on about Biden's age, whereas Trump makes endless mistakes, not just factual mistakes and so forth, but looks a lot older than Biden, is less physically able than Biden. He's vastly overweight, looks extremely unhealthy. Biden went for a swim in the ocean just recently over Thanksgiving. So he's fit, he's riding bicycles. If you read The Last Politician by Frank Ford, you can see that he's extremely well-informed and engaged, really a chief executive, and he has excellent people that he's picked around him, like Jake Sullivan, actually a lot of Irish-Americans, Mike Donlan, Jen O'Malley Dillon, John McCarthy. So he's in charge, and he shows every sign of being on top of things. Now, does he digress when he's telling a story? And don't we all? But that's been Joe Biden for years. It's what people actually like about him. He'd go off into an anecdote about his father for a few minutes, maybe even longer. And yet that's the way he is. He's very relatable. He's very honest. He's a practicing Catholic and an Irish-American, Scranton Joe. So these are all the things about Joe that make him liked by enormous amount of people. And I think his age is not going to be an issue, except for those people who want to make it an issue.
And I'm going to push back a little bit here. Joe Biden's poll numbers have been terrible for well over a year. So, what's going on?
Well, as Joe Biden said after the most recent elections when Democrats won across the country, polls are polls and people vote. I think what you get at the moment is, if I'm asked, are you happy with the way things are at the moment? Yeah, obviously, no, I'm not. Gee, I wish I could afford a house. I wish I could get more pay. I wish I could get promotion. The weather's cold. There are lots of things that if you want to just complain about, you'll complain about in any country. But when you're faced with the cold, hard choice between an incompetent proto-fascist like Trump and a competent, decent person like Biden, I think people will say do something different. But it's always different when it comes to the vote. Polls are about expressing your annoyance, dissatisfaction. Is it going to be a problem? Could be with the third-party candidates. Let's go back to when Clinton beat Bush Sr. and Ross Perot was the spoiler third-party candidate. Afterwards, when Clinton won, people came out and said, oh, it's the economy, stupid. People were upset about the economy and the standard of living and so forth, and that's why Bush lost. Bush largely lost because Ross took 30% of the vote away from him. And Clinton did not make 50%, it was less. So it was, in that case, if one of the third party candidates, and there are a few running, like Cornel West and this absurd Kennedy descendant, RFK Jr., who is anti-vaccine and has been a nutcase for years, excuse my language, if he were to draw away votes, that could hurt Biden. But I went to one of his rallies in New Hampshire, the RFK Jr. rallies in New Hampshire recently, and two things stood out for me. One, there was a big crowd there, and they were being very well fed and wined at enormous cost by somebody, allegedly Republicans who were backing Kennedy. And two, there were a lot of Trumpies there. I recognized them as neighbors in the area, and they were as much, probably more interested in RFK than local Democrats. So I think RFK will draw equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats, and maybe even more Republicans. So that might be a wash. Cornel West, very limited. But it will come down in the end. Will the black voters, will the Hispanic, will the young people, and will the women and the suburban people all come out and vote? And that one third, if it stays at home, Martin, it's going to be a problem for Democrats. But getting out the vote, getting people excited, either for Biden or against Trump, would be key.
Yeah, that's my take on it. The idea of an election of thirds and the ability to turn out the third at either end of the polarity. I expect, if Trump is the nominee, that the turnout model for Trump will be good. The passion is still there. I question the degree of passion that lies around Joe Biden. And I think that goes to a discussion of the state of the American polity. How is it that we have a candidate, Donald Trump, that is still considered to be viable despite all his legal difficulties? What does it say about the underlying state of America that people would consider this man to be an acceptable candidate? And how do you explain that to your Irish friends?
Well, I think it's the politics that's covered in America is considered more entertainment. I think football gets more serious attention than politics. A friend of mine said to me recently, if America was voting for a pilot for an aircraft, they would vote for the celebrity pilot who doesn't know how to fly the plane rather than the guy who actually could fly the plane. I mean, that clearly would be a disaster. It's a very strange thing. Certain mythologies have caught hold, like government doesn't matter or government is the problem, which Ronald Reagan preached a long time ago, and which people like Clinton reinforced to some extent by preaching against big government. And the people who believe that are the people who are getting most government benefits and support in a lot of these Republican-controlled states. Massive aid, Medicare, Social Security, and all sorts of benefits that people need. So what is it that makes people take politics less seriously and vote for people like Trump, who are about to want to dismantle the government and take away all the protections for ordinary people, which allows people to vote against their interests? And it's something they say, it's culture, it's identity politics. I think it's very simple, and it's the same in Europe, Martin. Mainstream politicians have forgotten ordinary folks. An effort to pursue free trade and a lot of other things, the so-called neoliberal agenda, they've neglected the people who didn't get a college education, are struggling, they're not earning a living wage, they can never put aside enough money, they have no savings, and they're very worried. And then they see crime rising, and they talk about immigration coming in, they're really upset about it. And so I think the border, the chaos of the U.S. border in the South, really is an issue. And that's one thing I would fault the Democrats for not doing enough about it. Not an easy one to solve, but this country needs immigration, and every country that has a low population growth needs immigration, but it needs it in an orderly way. And if you're a sovereign country, your borders have got to be secure. So I think that's where people are concerned. Is somebody listening to me? Is somebody going to improve my chances of security to own a house, not to have student debt, and so forth? And it's hard to get that done in Washington, where there are a lot of Republicans who want to destroy government. But gosh, that's the only way forward.
I'm going to shift our conversation, and it'll probably help us shift across the Atlantic. Obviously, the big news story that has been playing out in the month of November is what's going on in the Middle East, specifically Palestine, Israel. There's been much chatter in the American media that the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party is deeply upset at the Biden administration for their stalwart support of Israel, it seems, at all costs. Tell me what your thinking is around that particular issue, and is that a viable critique?
Well, it's a very complex one, and I think what the Biden administration has been saying consistently is they're for a two-state solution, and that Israel must start supporting that. Now, we've seen that the Israeli government in recent years has worked against that. They've worked against the PLO, the Palestinian group, being the legitimate representations of a secure state. And the illegal settlements in the West Bank, which have continued despite what President Obama tried to do, what President Biden tried to do, have really undermined support for Israel in some sections of American public. And that's not been anti-Semitic, that's people just being concerned that there isn't fair play for both Israel and for Palestine state. So that is an issue. It's upsetting a lot of people, even in the White House, that Biden appears to be just one-sided back in Israel. But at the same time, I think he has made it quite clear, increasingly in public, that there needs to be a continuation of the ceasefire and that hostages need to be returned. Young people and progressive Democrats in particular feel that Israel has, and a lot of Israelis feel this too, that the right-wing government has not served them well and that they need to have a two-state solution.
My take on it is that Biden is straddling a bit because he understands that traditionally America is very much a supporter of Israel and he can't withdraw support from Israel, specifically the Netanyahu government at a time when the government was attacked. But it feels like to me that he is shifting and bit by bit is putting more pressure on the Israeli administration to step back from what looks like to me little more than an effort to blanket bomb Gaza out of existence. I don't think that's a winning solution.
No, I think long term for Israel, that's very bad in terms of not just United States, but the European public opinion as well. What stood by Israel all these years is that it's a center of democracy and of moderation, and it needs to maintain that for any moral standing.
So I'm going to shift the focus across the Atlantic to Ireland, because if you wanted to look at a government and a polity that has a very different take on what's going on in Israel, and when you talk to our American listeners on just quite how different that situation is in terms of how people are reacting to what's going on in Israel. And what does that say to us about Ireland itself?
I would say that Ireland is still in support of firmly of a two-state solution. It believes in the Palestinian rights to coexist along with Israel. In many ways, it's a reflection of the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, where both north and south of Ireland recognized the right of a parity of esteem between nationalists and loyalists in Northern Ireland. So the ability to maintain support for a two-sided solution in Ireland or in Israel and Palestine maybe is what I think is the core thinking. And any one-sided approach to this is unpopular in Ireland. I mean, I don't think the Israeli foreign minister did himself any favors by attacking the Irish prime minister, the Taoiseach, for what was actually a very mild statement and misconstruing what he said as in some ways anti-Semitic. It's not at all. And to criticize the right-wing government in Israel is not anti-Semitic. It's a perfectly legitimate position to take, and it has been taken by 70% of Israelis themselves, who are very upset by not just a security failure, but years of policy denying a two-state approach. So Ireland is in some ways reflective of what's going on in Europe as well, and you've seen it in London, people supporting the Palestinian right to a state in very large marches. So I think it's possible to hold two things in your head. One is absolute condemnation of Hamas atrocities and need to return the hostages immediately. And secondly, support for a two-state solution. I don't see why that's complicated and why people can't hold that position without a lot of extreme ranting and raving.
Yeah, because I think in a time of crisis, polarities tend to get accentuated. So what are our polarities in this situation? We have Hamas on one side and we have the Netanyahu government on the other side. And both polarities are calling to their various sides to be either with us or against us. And so it is the middle that seems to me, the two-state solution type people, that seem to lose support for a more sane approach.
That's true, and it's no good. There's no future in that, because more people will die. More innocent lives will be lost. Again, to draw the parallel with Northern Ireland that went on for years during the Troubles. I recently read a very moving book by Martin Doyle called Dirty Linen, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's interested in Ireland or interested in the politics of conflict and what happens to people. If you wanted to check it on Irish Central, I reviewed it there. Doyle interviews the innocent victims of 30 years of violence in Northern Ireland. And it's very painful what he writes about in his own parish where he grew up in County Down. And as somebody said, memories are painful, but forgetting is more dangerous. We've got to remember victims and what we need to learn from that, which is this sort of violence is just going to create more hate, and it must be stopped somehow. And we must give politics a chance and give compromise a chance, because nobody can win everything.
Yes, I think when it comes to the issue of conflict and what we're seeing in Israel and Palestine, that Northern Ireland to some degree, and the Good Friday Agreements, is still a best of breed approach towards conflict resolution. Interestingly, despite the success in terms of tamping down violence in Northern Ireland, it feels to me that there are grave difficulties in Northern Ireland in terms of getting the assembly up and running. And I want to have your take on that, because it just feels everybody's locked into a position right now where nothing is getting done. And when nothing is getting done, frustration emerges. When frustration emerges, more polarity occurs. So, looking into your crystal ball, what are you seeing for Northern Ireland in 2024?
Well, I'm nothing if not an optimist, Martin. And I'm hoping that by the time this goes out, Geoffrey Donaldson will be announcing that they're going back into the executive and they're going to tackle the issues of housing, healthcare, education, that and employment, which are really pressing in Northern Ireland. It was last March that we had a meeting in Washington with Geoffrey Donaldson, and he said then he was hopeful that by April they would be back in the executive. So it's been a bit like waiting for Godot. In fact, Beckett's Waiting for Godot moves a lot faster than this particular show has moved. But I'm hopeful that he will get the votes and get the executive up and going. But by gosh, Northern Ireland needs it. I was in Northern Ireland in November for an interesting conference we had on bridging the Atlantic at Queen's University. And there just was a feeling of despair, really, that they had no government, things weren't under control. And a lot of people have said that as long as loyalists refuse to make Northern Ireland work, they're actually going to bring about a united Ireland faster. That it's in their interest to show that Northern Ireland can work and not just boycott the government and have things get worse and worse for ordinary people. So that, to me, means that Geoffrey Donaldson will get the vote. He's got a number of colleagues who are MPs in London who think that direct rule from London is the answer. But London has no interest, really, in running in Northern Ireland. We'll have less interest when Keir Starmer and the Labour Party win the likely election this year coming up. And in those circumstances, Northern Ireland has to look out for itself.
So I'm going to hop back south across the border again. We're popping around here a little bit and talking about conflict, because last week there were scenes of conflict on the streets of Dublin. Now, interestingly, I did read an article maybe a day or two ago in the Irish Times from Fintan O'Toole writing about right-wing riots in Ireland and reminding us that actually the ugly scenes that we saw on the streets of Dublin had also played out all too frequently in the 1920s and the 1930s streets of Dublin. And his point simply was that we are dealing with, in my view, at least that's what I took away from it, that we are dealing with a small group that have fantasies about a new wave of fascism. And so purported reason for these riots about issues about immigration, etc., are not really what's at stake here. But I'm interested to hear your take on what you saw and what you read about what happened in Dublin last week, which was, just to explain, our listeners may not be fully aware, there was a stabbing of some young children outside a school, which quickly triggered an escalation in violence that was called for by far-right types in response to the supposed attack perpetrated by an immigrant.
In fact, the immigrant was a naturalized Irish citizen, had been in the country for 20 years and had mental health issues. And the people who tackled him were themselves immigrants. They at great personal risk to themselves, including a Filipino nurse and a Brazilian delivery rider, took him down. Clinton had a great line. He said, "Fascism in Ireland is an indigenous strain of nastiness and pious hooliganism that's in the subsoil." I love that, pious hooliganism. Yeah, there's nothing particularly new about that. But I would take a contrary view. I would say that the Irish government has neglected the terrible issue of housing and healthcare shortages in Ireland for too long. And that combined with public safety issues. The Gardaí are restrained by all sorts of inquiries if they lift a hand to deal with hooligans or thugs in the streets of Dublin or any other city. They need to be enabled and given proper support, social services support. They have too many revolving prison doors. They arrest somebody, they're out the next day, they're taunting the Gardaí again. So we've got to get on top of some of these issues. I know people think Michael McDowell is a bit right-wing, but he's written very well on this. And in fact, Simon Coveney came out recently saying we should reconsider putting asylum seekers in hotels in the inner cities. That's a provocation to people. I hear ordinary people have nowhere to stay, they have no apartments, and yet we're taking in many, many asylum seekers into the inner cities. We're taking in so many now that there are 400 of them living in tents in Dublin. I saw that last week when I was over there. So there's a sense in which, back to the American issue of the border security, that we're not on top of all these issues and that we need to do what we can to look after migrants and refugees, but within our means. There's no point just dumping people on a city or a community in Massachusetts or in Wexford and saying, okay, you deal with it. We're not giving you any extra education facilities. We're not giving you any more job availability or housing, but you deal with it. Local people don't like that. And it's led to a lot of reaction in countries that were always very progressive. Scandinavian countries, we saw it recently in the Netherlands. People just get upset and feel that they're not being treated with respect. I'm not a right-winger, but I'm also not somebody who wants to ignore what ordinary people are thinking and feeling and saying. They live in neighborhoods which are endangered. They don't live in nice middle-class neighborhoods where there's very little crime. And these people have a vote, should have a vote, and they need to be heard.
Yeah, and I think there's a legitimate concern, I would agree with that, about migrant pressure. And once you look across multiple geographies, you see it everywhere. You can talk about the southern border in America. You can talk about the crisis in the Mediterranean. So this is playing out in real time, but nobody seems to be framing it very well. The big question is, why is it happening? And in my view, it's happening because of stressors of climate change, which is forcing people to migrate north,
either
from Africa or either from Central America, simply that a lot of these folks were subsistence farmers. They were living a very precarious situation. A small shift, well, not even a small shift, but a shift in temperatures in the overall climate is making their existing non-viable. The big question is, for Western democracies, what do they do? Have we gotten to a point, and one of the important questions to ask is, what is a reasonable absorption rate for given countries to bring in migrants? Because I'm a big believer in migration. I am a migrant.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that migrants make enormous contributions to economies. An interesting stat from the Irish government is 1 in 4 of Irish workers is not born in Ireland. So, big question. How do Western governments get on top of this? Are they talking properly about this? Are they framing it in an intelligent way? And what's the way forward?
Yeah. Well, I think getting on top of it, first of all, means in America, certainly securing the border. There's a ludicrous situation now whereby if somebody enters illegally, they're arrested and then told that they can stay in the country until their hearing takes place. So they disappear somewhere into the country. Even if they give an address, they don't have any fixed address. They don't know where they're going to get their next job. They go off and work in some meat packing factory in some terrible conditions or whatever in some part of the country, and they never come back for that court hearing. So there are millions of people who have no documentation in the United States. That actually suits the capitalist system, because these are workers who work for below rates. They don't have insurance. They can't complain to anybody. And we know that Trump actually employed some of them in Mar-a-Lago before he was outed on this subject. So it's a dirty little secret whereby these people are let in, they have no rights, and they have no way towards citizenship. There's something like 10 million and rising every month by another million. So that is out of control, and the people who suffer are the people who are marginalized already in America, and not the, as I say, the middle class or the owners who have cheap labor. That's not acceptable. And the definition of sovereignty going way back to Roman times is, do you control your border? Do you have citizens? And do those citizens have rights over other people? That may seem not fair to the rest of the world, but at some stage, in order to protect democracy within the United States and within European countries, there needs to be control at the border. We saw that in South Africa. They had very little control over who came in from the rest of Africa, and there are many cases that are overrun by crime, destroying the structure of the country, and that's not a formula for success. That's a formula for populism, for fascism, and for a reaction, and that's the truth of the matter. So what do you do? I think you continue to fight against climate change. You continue to fight for aid for those countries, for supporting people where they are, whether it's in Mexico or whether it's in Morocco or in Nigeria, and that's the only way forward. We cannot solve the problems of Africa or of South America by bringing all those people into the United States or into the European Union. And that's just the truth of the matter. Does that sound right-wing? I don't think so. I think it's common sense. But people use brands and labels in a very generic and, I think, dumb way. We've got to just talk facts and talk about policy and what we can do to make lives better for everybody, wherever they live.
So, again, let's take a look into our crystal ball now as we're beginning to approach a close here. Elections next year. We know there will be an election in November in the United States, and a very important election. We know there will be an election in Britain next year, and quite an important one there. Ireland, will there be an election in the Republic? And what's your take on all three elections to be, or possible election?
Quick one. Biden wins against Trump. Democrats get the House back but lose the Senate. So divided government in Washington. In Britain, Keir Starmer wins. A new Prime Minister, Labour, comes back into power. Ireland is a more problematic one to call, because Sinn Féin are the largest party now, but they can't govern, unlikely to be able to govern by themselves. And if they were to put together a government, would Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael go into government with them? The prospects for the junior party in any coalition are not great. The Irish Labour Party have demonstrated that. The British Liberal Party demonstrated that. If Fianna Fáil were to go in, they might quickly find that a lot of their supporters next time will vote either for Fine Gael or for Sinn Féin. So it's a dilemma. Proportional representation does create multi-party constituencies. I wouldn't rule out that at the end of the day, if Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael were to get their act together in the next 9 months and actually introduce proper public safety measures and a home building emergency program, they might actually win people back. I really don't understand why the present coalition does not have a home building program, an emergency one, appropriate land, and build the structures. We have this quite significant budget surplus. They're talking about building a sovereign fund. Why build a sovereign fund when you could spend the money now to create a healthier democracy and also sustain yourself in power? It boggles my mind, Martin. I really don't understand it. In the past, Fianna Fáil, in the old days, would have been building affordable housing left, right, and center. That was their thing. They seem to have walked away from that in a strange way. And I think if Sinn Féin do get into power, That's what they will do. That's what they need to do, at least demonstrate that they're competent in government.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm reminded that Fianna Fáil rose to power in the 1930s on the back of a house building program.
Yeah.
That housing itself in Ireland has always been a problem. I also had the pleasure of meeting Dara O'Brien recently down in Georgia, who is the Minister of Housing and Heritage. And I've been following him since then. He actually comes from my hometown in Malahide. And I've been following him since then, and I've noticed pretty much every day on LinkedIn, Facebook, etc., he is cutting a ribbon in one place or another for housing. So here's the problem with housing, in my view, in Ireland. And it's not specifically an Irish problem. I think in any major successful economy that you see these kind of fault lines of pressure around housing, because of the success of an economy, affordability issues kick in and cause problems. To move the needle on housing and housing construction takes a few years. And it feels to me that the Irish government got slowed down by COVID. And it feels to me, just like with Joe Biden's improving inflation numbers, that the actual housing numbers are starting to move. The big question is, will they move fast enough?
Yes.
And when will people actually recognize that? So I'm certainly persuadable that not enough has been done in Ireland to address the housing problem. I think the messaging has been poor in terms of the criticality of the situation. But I think it's an extraordinarily important issue.
Good, I agree. And we'll just see. It's all to play for. I don't think any government would wait until the last minute to call an election. My view is that sometime in September, October, after a reasonable budget, might be the best time for the coalition to go ahead with an election.
So with that, the crystal ball has been polished up a little bit. I hope we have the opportunity to hold you to account for your predictions, maybe this time next year. I'm hopeful that, let's say, the hotspots in the globe in the upcoming year will hopefully cool down a little bit, and that we can start stabilizing a lot of the stressors that appear to be present in many Western democracies. But on behalf of our listeners and myself, I'd like to thank Ted for coming on the podcast as our first four-time guest. I'm looking for his fifth time next year, and I look forward to continuing the conversation over the next 12 months.
Thank you, and am I allowed to put in a New Year's resolution?
Absolutely.
Or maybe it's even my plug, shameless plug. One of them would be that as many of you as are in New York or visit New York, please come to Luxman Ireland House in NYU. Martin's a regular down there. We always look forward to seeing him. We have our March 5 gala coming up with Michael O'Halloran receiving the Lute Luxman Award. Claire Keegan, many of you will have read her books, will also be coming from Ireland for the Seamus Heaney Award. And Peggy Noonan, who now writes for the Wall Street Journal, who has been a journalist, columnist, much loved for many years, getting the Pete Hamill Award. That's always good. And in terms of my hopes for the year, that more and more people will leave Twitter and go to Threads, that we'll have peace in the Middle East and Ukraine, and maybe this last one's a bit trivial, but let's give up buying plastic water bottles in terms of trying to help the environment and deal with some of the plastic mountains that are and countries that are in the oceans right now. So that's it from me. Suffice to say, Martin, this has been a tremendous opportunity and privilege. I love what you're doing with Irish Jew. Your interviews across the past year have been fabulous, and let's keep up the great work you're doing.
Thank you so much for the kind words, Ted, and as always, it's been a pleasure.
Hey, it's Martin. Thanks for listening. It's always a pleasure to talk politics with Ted Smith. He's thoughtful and a total gentleman, and while gentility may be considered a quaint notion in the current political world, Ted's demeanor reminds me that many have forgotten how to engage politically with those that hold different views. I'd like to leave you with this thought. We need to be able to disagree with each other on matters political without descending into bitterness and invective. It's all right to say that you have a different take on the world without torching family and friend relationships. Ultimately, we all want what is best for our country. Let's not lose sight of our ability to be civil in this new year. If you've enjoyed this show, please follow the podcast, leave a comment, or share it with a friend. This is Martin Nutty, and you've been listening to Irish Stew. Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.